Could I ask you to start by turning back for a moment to chapter 5? And to look briefly at verse 15 and then verse 20. Chapter 5, verse 15, it's a passage where Paul is contrasting Adam and his disobedience and the consequences of that, and Jesus and his obedience and the consequences of that. And in verse 15 he says, if the many died by the trespass of the one man, that is Adam, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? That is to say, sin and grace are not equal and opposite. Grace is stronger than sin. And then if you glance ahead at verse 20, he says something very similar in some ways. The law was added so that the trespass might increase. That's not our subject today. But he goes on, but where sin increased, grace increased all the more. It is in the nature of grace to overflow. And that, in a way, is our theme in Romans 11. That grace will never be satisfied. That is to say, a gracious God will never be satisfied to stop at the boundary of any group, any national group, any ethnic group, any cultural group, any language group. The gracious God is always, because this is in the nature of grace in the heart of God, will always overflow. Now, I'm thrilled about Romans 11. It's a chapter most people fight shy of because, of course, it does have its difficulties. We'll note them. We won't be able to spend long on them because we're going to tackle the whole chapter in one go. But I'm thrilled with Romans 11. As I've been grappling with Romans 11, or God has been grappling with me, it seems to me Romans has a tremendous message that is basically very simple and very clear and very relevant and very practical for all Christian people. And so I want us to, my prayer is that we'll end up thrilled with the central, simple message of Romans 11, and that we won't go home thinking, gosh, that was awfully puzzling. There are puzzles and there are difficulties, and we'll note them. And, if you want to stop me enjoying my supper, you're very welcome to ask me what I think about them. But the main point is what we're going to do. We're going to try and stay as much as we can on the main road. So here we go. First of all, verses 1 to 10. Because we've got a handout, we've got long headings. God has not rejected his people, but his people are chosen by grace and therefore not quite who we might expect. Paul picks up after verse with which we ended this morning, chapter 10, verse 21, with God, as it were, holding out his hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. And Paul now asks the obvious question, has God rejected his people? Has he said, well, I've held out my hands to them, but they haven't responded, so we'll give up on the promise? I've made a promise, and I've held out my hands, and I've said to them, come on, guys, why don't you cooperate with the promise? And they haven't cooperated, so why don't we just give up on the promise? That, of course, would be a problematical understanding of God. But that's what Paul is grappling with. And he says, did God reject his people? No, he says emphatically, by no means. And his first answer, this is just a preliminary answer, is himself. He says, I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, that is a seed of Abraham, a spiritual descendant, not just an ethnic descendant, but a spiritual descendant of Abraham, from the tribe of Benjamin, very distinguished tribe, something he would have been proud of, as he says in Philippians chapter 3, Saul's tribe, the first king. So he says God didn't reject his people, and the first proof is that I'm in his people. And I guess the reason he chooses himself is not egocentricity, but I guess he's saying, what an unlikely person. What an unlikely person who opposed Jesus as the Christ, persecuted his followers, hounded them into prison and death, a blasphemer, as he says elsewhere. What an unlikely person. And yet I've been brought in. And I belong to the real people of God by grace. So if he could do it for me, He can do it for those reluctant, those resistant Jews in the synagogue in Rome. So don't give up on them. It's going to be one of the big choruses, really, through Romans 11. Don't give up on these people. So God hasn't rejected them, whom he foreknew. And whom he foreknew picks up, of course, on those he foreknew in chapter 8. And those he foreknew is not, of course, the whole of ethnic Israel. It's the whole argument of chapter 9, that those he foreknew is a subset. It's Isaac but not Ishmael, it's Jacob but not Esau, and so on. It's those on whom he's chosen to have mercy, those whom he has foreknown and entered into relationship with, as it were, before the foundation of the earth. But Paul is not content with one counterexample. And he then goes on to another, and these are very carefully chosen. He says, don't you know what the scripture says in the passage about Elijah, 1 Kings 19? How he appealed to God against Israel, and the context was so similar. Elijah ministering in the northern kingdom, Israel, at the time when the kingdom was divided, at a time when the large majority of people were turning away in unfaithfulness to the covenant. Exactly the same situation in Paul's day. Most of his fellow countrymen turning away in unfaithfulness to the covenant. And Elijah, and we know the story so well, don't we, how he appeals to God. And he says, Lord, this is awful. Verse 3, they've killed your prophets, your authoritative messengers. They've torn down your altars. They're not engaged in proper worship. And I am the only one left. They're trying to kill me, said he all gloomily. That's the sense of it. Now, and Paul picks that because he wants to remind them of God's answer, verse 4. What was God's answer to him? I've reserved for myself 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And Elijah wasn't aware of that, or if he was, he'd forgotten. And it's very carefully chosen, because Paul is saying to the church in Rome, there may be all sorts of people, all sorts of surprising people, including some of those Jews who at present are so hostile in the synagogue. And there may be all sorts of people whom God has chosen from all eternity and who will come to faith in Christ. So open your eyes to the horizons of grace, because they're bigger than you think. So too, verse 5, at the present time, just the same, there is a remnant chosen by grace. It's always been chosen by grace. It's always been chosen by the promise, the choice, the call of God, as in chapter 9. And if by grace, God's free initiative, then it is no longer by works. No longer doesn't mean that it ever was by works. Paul isn't saying it used to be by works, but it isn't by works anymore. What he's saying, because it never was by works, read the Old Testament, that's quite clear. What he's saying is we must no longer think or speak as though it were by works. That would be a mistake. Because if it had been by works, grace would no longer be grace. So it must always be by the grace of God. But verse 7, what then? We need to be realistic about the other side. What Israel sought so earnestly, do you remember the end of chapter 9? They pursued zealously the righteousness as if by law. What Israel sought so earnestly, it did not obtain, but the elect did. That is, the elect, the chosen remnant within Israel, obtained it. So when he says Israel didn't obtain it, that's a generalization. Israel as a whole didn't obtain it, but the elect, those chosen within Israel, the remnant, did obtain it, although the rest were hardened, as it is written. And then he quotes, it's a composite quotation, it's mainly from Deuteronomy 29. It's the same sermon we looked at this morning, Deuteronomy 29 and 30, where Moses says to the people, you've seen all these wonderful things in the Exodus and the provision in the wilderness and all God's grace and care. You've seen it all, but you haven't got it, have you? You've seen it, but you haven't seen it. There's a play on the word seen in that sermon in Deuteronomy 29. And God gave them a spirit of stupor. That's actually a phrase from Isaiah 29. But the meaning is the same. Eyes that wouldn't see, you were like drunk people, and ears that wouldn't hear, right down to today. So Paul says that there are some who are hardened, and they haven't got it, and they haven't seen it. And then there's a quotation from Psalm 69, where David prays for the judgment of God. It's a psalm that's often quoted of Jesus in the New Testament in all sorts of different places. And I guess Paul picks it particularly because of the reference to eyes being darkened so they cannot see. So there is this hardening. There is this sense of some who are going to be hardened, even as others have not bowed the knee to Baal. So there are these two sides to it in verses 1 to 10. There is a remnant, the elect, some amongst the Israelites who are chosen by grace and who respond. But there are others who are being hardened and who don't and won't get it. But I think the point of the quotation from Elijah is to say to us, to unsettle us and to unsettle the Christians in Rome, to think, don't ever think that we know where the limits are and who's on which side. Because that was what Elijah was doing. You can understand it. He was saying there doesn't seem to be anybody faithful except poor old me, and I'm about to get the chop. And the point about that is to open Elijah's eyes to the fact that the grace and the mercy of God might be bigger than he thinks. So that's my first heading, and it's a partial heading, really, because it leads straight in to the next bit. Now, I've given an overall heading, although I'll subdivide it, for the main chunk of the letter, of the chapter 11 to 32. And I've called it this: what is happening now is not the end of the story of overflowing grace. I got that expression, not the end of the story, from Mark Ashton, whom I trained under. And again in some pastoral situation where there was a disappointment or a discouragement or a setback with somebody or a couple or a family in the church, he would say to me, just remember, it's not the end of the story. And that stuck with me as a pastor. And I need to say to myself sometimes, do you know, just remember, Christopher, that is not the end of the story. And that's the message of Romans 11. And it's a tremendous encouragement. Now, as we work through it, verses 11 to 15 teach Paul's contemporaries that present Jewish unbelief is not the end of the story. So verse 11, again I ask, did they stumble? You remember they stumbled over the stumbling block. That is, they didn't submit to Christ, in order that they might fall beyond recovery. Now, if we'd been asked that question, we would have said presumably yes. We'd have said they've stumbled, they haven't believed in Christ, they won't submit to Christ, who is the righteousness of God, so presumably they're going to fall beyond recovery. Presumably they're heading for hell. That's what we would have said. And Paul says, and this is the mark of a preacher who understands the overflowing nature of grace, Paul says, not at all. And then he begins to unlock the purpose and the wonder of the grace of God, to open our eyes to that grace. Let me tell you at the beginning the three-stage process that he goes round and round and keeps coming back to all through the chapter. The three-stage process is summarized in a nutshell in verse 11. Stage one, he says, because of their transgression. Stage one is that Israel is hardened. Most of Israel are hardened because of their transgression. Stage two, the Gentiles are brought in. So but the verse goes on. Because of their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles. That is exactly what happened in the Acts of the Apostles, isn't it? That's almost the story of the Acts of the Apostles. Again and again, for example, in Acts 18, he goes to Corinth, he's rejected by the synagogue. He says, from now on I will go to the Gentiles. Again in Rome, in chapter 28, he's rejected by most of the Jews. And he says, let it be known to you that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles. They'll listen. So stage one and stage two we're very familiar with. Because the Jews rejected, mostly, a few accepted, but mostly they rejected, the grace of God overflowed to the Gentiles. It's worth remembering that, isn't it? That we'd never have got the gospel if the Jews had all cheerfully accepted it. If the Jews in the synagogues around the Mediterranean had all said, yeah, brilliant, it wouldn't have overflowed in the way that it has overflowed. And this is how the grace of God works. People reject and the message overflows elsewhere. So that's stage one and stage two. But it's stage three that makes Paul really excited. Why did this happen? Why did they reject? Well, first, so that Gentiles will be brought in. But third, you see in verse 11, to make Israel envious or jealous. That is to say, he's picking up on the prophecy in Moses' song in chapter 10, verse 19. I will make you envious or jealous. Let me pause on this for a moment and then we'll accelerate through the next few verses. This only works if a people who are shaped by grace have something deeply attractive about them. This dynamic here that runs right through Romans 11 only makes sense if a community who are shaped by grace, there's something very attractive about them. Because the logic is this. We reject the grace of God. The grace of God overflows to other people. And then we look at those other people living in fellowship with God under his grace. And we look at them and we see something there that we want. That's how it works. That is to say, we see there people who are visibly, in the way they relate to one another, evidencing the fact that they're living under the grace of God. There's a thankfulness, there's an attractiveness, there's a forbearance, there's a patience, there's a graciousness in the way they behave. That makes me look at that and think, you know, I want that. And then I am softened. That's what he says. So as to make Israel envious. So he's going to go round and round this thing, and we'll speed up a bit. Verse 12. So he says, if their transgression, that is stage one, means riches for the world, that great overflow to the Gentile world, Gentile mission of the church, breaking the boundaries. And then the same thing, if their loss, stage one, means riches for the Gentiles, that is the rest of the world, stage two, how much greater riches will their fullness bring? And that word fullness is repeated. Here it's used of the Jews, and it's repeated in verse 25 of the Gentiles. And it refers to the full number of God's elect Israelites, who will finally, all through the ages, be brought to faith in Christ. And he says, this is going to be a greater thing and a bigger thing than we've yet seen. It's as though he's saying to them, you ain't seen nothing yet of the grace and the wonder of God. Now, verse 13, he makes it quite clear who he's talking to. Verse 13, he says, I'm talking to you Gentiles. And just to get our bearings, he's talking to the Gentiles because he wants to keep them humble. Just glance on for a moment at verse 18, where he says to them, don't boast. And then verse 20, where he says to them, don't be arrogant. And then verse 25, where he says, so that you may not be conceited. So Paul is writing to Gentile Christians who have received the grace of God, or at least they claim they have, in order to humble them. So there's another clue. If we end up having understood Romans 11 right, we'll be humbled by it. If we're not humbled by it, we won't have understood Romans 11 right. So verse 13, I'm talking to you Gentiles. Inasmuch as I am the apostle to the Gentiles, which of course Paul was, I make much of my ministry. You know, I make a big thing that I am the apostle to the Gentiles. And it's a great thing to be an apostle, the apostle to the Gentiles, he says. But this is so humbling. You see, if I'm a bit of an uppity Gentile, I say to myself, he's the apostle to the Gentiles. That means I must be quite important. I must be something special. But look how he goes on. I make much of my ministry in the hope that I may somehow arouse my own people to envy and save some of them. Now, if I am a Gentile, I might be slightly miffed by that. See, he's saying to me, Christopher, I make a great big deal of the fact that you're a Gentile and I'm trying to reach you for Christ, and I'm pleased that I've reached you for Christ, but it's not because you're very special, it's just that I'm really hoping and praying that you and those other Gentiles will become such an attractive proposition that my own people will look at you and think, "What isn't the grace of God wonderful?" and be saved. And it's in the nature of God, of grace, that it never stops with us. That's why it's so important, isn't it, to look outwards as churches. It's in the nature of grace that it never stops at any boundary, any border of culture. It's the nature of the grace of God that it's always reaching one group of people in order to reach another group of people. And Paul is praying that in this case it's going to bounce back, as it were, to his people. So verse 15, "For if their rejection," stage one, that is their rejection of God and by God, "is the reconciliation of the world," he's speaking generally, he's not speaking universally that every Gentile is going to believe, but if their rejection, stage one, leads to massive great reconciliation with God all over the world, as it does, what will their acceptance be? What will it happen when it bounces back? But life from the dead, and nobody knows exactly what life from the dead means there. I think probably it means spiritual life, in the sense of chapter 6, verse 13, but that's one of the puzzles of the chapter, exactly what he means by that. So there's the first sub-point there. Present Jewish unbelief is not the end of the story, so don't give up on them. But now he focuses very much on the Gentiles, verse 16 onwards, and he says, "If you're a proud Gentile, remember your roots and how you're connected to them." So verse 16, he picks just very briefly one little image. If the parts of the dough, this is the offering of a loaf, Numbers 15 is the Old Testament background. If you offer a bit of the loaf as first fruits, as according to the Old Testament law, it has a kind of knock-on effect on the whole of your harvest. But he then changes immediately to the metaphor that he runs with much more, which is the metaphor of an olive tree, an image of Israel, of the people of God. If the root, that is the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the promises, if the root is holy, then so are the branches, so long as they're connected to the root. And that's going to be his point. So verse 17, if some of the branches, some of the Jewish people have been broken off, and they have, lots of them around the Mediterranean world of Paul's day, people who've hardened themselves and been hardened against the gospel. If some of the branches are broken off, and you, though a wild olive shoot, it's not very flattering, is it? You, though a kind of weed, that's what we are, my friends, we are weeds. And you, though a kind of weed, have been grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing sap from the olive root, don't boast over those branches. And if you do start boasting, verse 18, consider this. You do not support the root, but the root supports you. One of the great dangers in church life is when somebody begins to think that they support the church. I suppose you have anybody like that at All Souls, but it does occasionally happen in churches that somebody begins to behave as though the church depends on them. And God depends on them, and God is quite lucky to have them on his team. Some of the Gentiles in Rome might have been behaving a little bit like that, and he's saying, remember your roots. And then he's going to spell it out more carefully. Verse 19, you will say then, branches were broken off so that I could be grafted in. You can imagine the Gentile in Rome, can't you, in the church, saying, yeah, but Paul, hang on a minute. All those lot who were part of the outward people of God, they've been broken off so that I could come in, so I must be pretty special. God must have looked round the Mediterranean world and thought, hey, he looks a good guy, she looks a good girl, we'll bring them in. And Paul says, yes, but, verse 20, they were broken off because of unbelief. That's why they're broken off, because of unbelief. And you stand by faith. That is to say, you stand fast by faith and by faith alone. And the moment you begin to be proud and arrogant and conceited, you move towards the dangerous boundaries of grace and faith, because the opposite of faith is pride. The opposite of faith is not just unbelief. The opposite of faith is pride. The moment I begin to be conceited and arrogant and think that I'm someone special, then I cease to exercise faith. And given that's why they're broken off, if I do that, it's just as dangerous. So verse 20, don't be arrogant, but be afraid. That is, stand in awe. Stand in awe of the wonderful grace of God, and don't ever lose that sense of wonder. Because verse 21, if God did not spare the natural branches, then he certainly won't spare you either. The principle that we come to God empty-handed in faith, dependent entirely on grace, that applies just as much to you as to them, just as much to them as to you. Nothing has changed. So it's very sobering, this, for the Gentile Christian. It's sobering for the person who's been in church for a while and who wears the T-shirt and who speaks the language and can sit confidently in a fellowship group, finding their place in the Bible with some confidence, giving the occasional impressive cross-reference so people think, gosh, they know their Bible well. You know this, don't you, in fellowship groups? It's very dangerous. Because the moment I begin to think to myself, I begin to go home thinking, do you know, I'm really quite special. Do you know, I'm really quite good at this kind of stuff. Do you know, God must be very happy to have me on his team. The moment I begin to think that, I place myself in real danger. Because the only thing that connects me to the root, to the promise of God, is faith, which is so humbling. So verse 22, consider therefore, think about, don't just skip over this, but consider therefore the kindness and the sternness or the severity of God. Consider both sides of this. Sternness to those who fell. Consider that God always blinds the eyes of the proud. God always empties the full. God always humbles the arrogant. He always has and he always will. Consider that sternness to those who fell. And remember his kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. That is, you continue in faith and humble harmony in the church. Otherwise, you also will be cut off. And then just to make sure that we really are humble, verse 23, if they did not persist, or if they do not persist, I'm not sure that did is quite the best translation there, if they do not persist in their unbelief, then they'll be grafted in, because God is able to graft them in again. After all, he says, if he's grafted in weeds, it's really quite easy to graft in olive branches. That's a paraphrase of verse 24. If he can bring a Gentile in, who's a complete outsider, a complete nobody, a complete no-hoper, a complete weed, he can certainly bring in someone who's got the background and the Bible knowledge and so on. And then he gets to the next stage. I've given it the same subheading as the first one. Present Jewish unbelief is not the end of the story. And here there are some puzzles, but I want us to try and stay on the main road and not to go too far off on the detours. Verse 25 should begin with the word for. For I do not want you. He's continuing the same argument. And I don't think he's actually introducing anything new here. Although we'll look at that in a moment. For I don't want you to be ignorant, he says, of this mystery. And the word mystery, as you know, in the New Testament, is used of the gospel or of some aspect of the gospel that was hidden but is now revealed. So you can trace that through. In 1 Corinthians 15, it's the bodily resurrection. In Ephesians, it's that Jews and Gentiles are brought together in Christ. In Romans 16:25, it's just the gospel generally. It's always the gospel or some aspect of the gospel that was hidden, was shadowy in the Old Testament, but is now crystal clear. Do you know Augustine's little image that the Old Testament was like a fully furnished but darkened room? What Augustine meant by that was that the Old Testament contained all the furniture of the gospel, but it's shadowy and dark, and it's hard to see it. And what the gospel does is not introduce furniture that wasn't there before. What the gospel does is turn the light on so that we see it, and it's clearly revealed. So that's what the gospel is doing here. He says, I don't want you to be ignorant of this mystery. So this isn't some sort of secret thing. This is something that was hidden but is now revealed in the gospel. And the reason I don't want you to be ignorant is that, say, you may not be conceited. So it's the same theme. He wants to humble the Gentile who's getting a bit uppity about grace, who's getting proud of grace in a paradoxical way. So he says, I don't want you to be ignorant. And then he gives three elements of this. A, Israel has experienced a hardening in part. That, of course, is stage one of the three-stage thing he's been developing all through the chapter. Israel has experienced a partial hardening, a hardening in part. B, until the full number, the fullness, it's the same word as in verse 12, until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Now that corresponds to stage two. Let's just pause on those. Stages one and two are happening at the same time, aren't they? While the partial hardening is happening, the Gentiles are being brought in. Stages one and two are not sequential stages of three different times. Stages one and two are happening at the same time. And stage three, he puts slightly cryptically, verse 26, and so all Israel will be saved. And of course, that's the big puzzle and controversial verse. And I'll come back to that in just a moment. He quotes in support a quotation from Isaiah 59, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will turn godlessness away from Jacob, which is a new covenant prophecy. Prophecy of the time when the deliverer, the rescuer, will come from Zion and banish ungodliness away from Jacob. In other words, change the hearts of God's people. And then a quotation from Isaiah 27. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. Another new covenant prophecy. So this is not talking about salvation outside of Christ. There is no salvation outside of Christ. But the question is, what does he mean, all Israel will be saved? There's a variety of suggestions that have been made. I'm going to give you my suggestion, and you're very welcome to ask me, if we have time for questions at the end or over supper, why I think what I think. I think that the word Israel in Romans 11 most naturally does apply to Jews rather than Gentiles. So the suggestion has been made that all Israel simply means the whole people of God, Jew and Gentile. All the people of God in every age will be saved, which of course would be perfectly true. There's nothing wrong with that. I just don't think the use of the word Israel in Romans 11, it does seem to be used of Jews rather than Gentiles. Many people think, many Christians believe, that Paul is prophesying and teaching some kind of end-time, large-scale conversion of the Jewish people to Christ. That, as it were, just before the return of Christ or something like that, there'll be a large-scale turning of Jewish people to Christ. I'm among those who am not persuaded that he is teaching that, but if I'm proved to be wrong, no one will be more cheerful than me. You know, that is to say, there's no point fighting over this. You know, if at the end there's a great large-scale turning of Jewish people to Christ, we're all going to be cheering, aren't we? And praising the grace of God. So we don't need to quarrel over that. My reasons for not being persuaded that he is teaching that are five. First of all, it's that this dynamic of jealousy or envy speaks not of an end-time crisis, but of an ongoing process. What Paul has in mind is grace overflowing to people, and other people, in this case the unbelieving Jews, seeing that grace in his age and every age and being attracted by it. That is an ongoing process of grace. Second, Paul's aim in verse 14 is to save some of his people, which makes more sense, again, if it's an ongoing process. Paul is actually hoping that in his lifetime, in his ministry, some of these people, his fellow countrymen, Jews, are going to be saved. And I take it in every age that's something we should hope for and pray for all who have hardened themselves against Christ, not just Jews. My third reason is that it's not clear that an end-time last generation turning of Jews to Christ does the Jews much good in between times. I mean, it'll be a wonderful thing if it happens. But Paul's heart, which I take it is an echo of the heart of God, is that Jews of every age, hardened people of every age, will be softened by grace. My fourth reason is that the prophecy or teaching of an end-time turning of the Jews doesn't seem to be clearly taught anywhere else in the New Testament. That doesn't mean it's wrong, but it makes us cautious about interpreting a difficult and puzzling passage. And my fifth reason is that Paul's aim in Romans 11 is to humble the Gentile believers in the present. And it's not particularly clear how the prophecy of an end generation, end time turning, is going necessarily to humble them in the present. And I think it makes more sense, therefore, to see that Paul is describing an ongoing process with these three ingredients: hardening, overflow to others, jealousy on the behalf of those who've been hardened, who are thereby softened, and some of them receive Christ. But if you know, people, Christians get very attached to one view or another of Romans 11, and fisticuffs probably aren't quite the point of the chapter. Sometimes people say, if my reading of it is right, what's the point of saying all Israel will be saved? Isn't that rather obvious? You know, if it just means that all the elect Israelites are going to be saved, surely that's kind of true by definition if they're elect. And I think the point is, and unfortunately the NIV it doesn't translate this very, very helpfully, but in verse 26, and so, the word's translated "and so," and in this way all Israel will be saved. And I think what Paul is teaching is that is not that all the elect Israelites will be saved, because that's kind of true by definition, but that in this extraordinarily paradoxical way of hardening, followed by overflowing grace to others, followed by jealousy, they're going to be saved. That is, as it were, the marvellous process by which God is going to bring in all those of his people whom he's chosen. Let me take us through to the end, and then we'll think about how we might apply all this to ourselves. Verse 28, as regards the gospel, as far as the gospel is concerned, they're enemies on your account. Well, they certainly were historically. Read the Acts of the Apostles. It's full of that. And in every age, there's none so hostile to real Christianity as nominal Christianity. Isn't that true? Where does the hostility come to real Christianity? In the Church of England, for example? Answer, by false Christianity within the Church of England. It's always been the case. So there's nothing new there. But, says Paul, as far as election is concerned, they're loved on account of the patriarchs. That is to say, those amongst those amongst the unbelieving Jews, those in our age amongst people who are at present hardened against Christ, who in the purposes of God are elect, and we don't know how big that boundary goes. Elijah got it wrong. We're always inclined to get it wrong and to think that it's smaller than it is, are loved on account of the patriarchs. For God's gifts and his call are irrevocable. Once God has set his love on a human being, then even if that human being is behaving like Paul was before his conversion, one day they're going to come to Christ. So Paul sums it up in 30, 31, 32. Just as you, who were at one time disobedient to God, have now received mercy as a result of their disobedience. That's stages one and two. Their disobedience, an overflow of mercy to you. So they too have now become disobedient in order that they too may now receive mercy as a result of God's mercy to you. It looks a bit complicated, but it's stage three. God's mercy to you is going to make them jealous, and then they're going to be softened and receive mercy. And then summary, verse 32, for God has bound all men over to disobedience. That's not a universal statement. These alls are general loads of people kind of alls, as they often are in Scripture. God has bound all kinds of people over to disobedience so that he can have mercy on all kinds of people. That's a summing up, really, of the whole process. And then Paul concludes, and in summary, I think in a way this is the doctrine of the whole of Romans, because all our rescue is all of his grace, it will be all to his glory. I think in a way this is a nutshell summary of the whole of Romans. The whole story is the grace of God, and therefore all the glory will go to God. It's not that the story is 99% his grace and 1% our very sensible decisions. It is that the story is 100% his grace, and therefore all of the glory will be to him. And therefore in the new creation, it won't be what somebody has called a prigsty, full of stuck-up prigs, and he'll be saying to one another, how did you get in here? Well, I very sensibly decided for Christ. How about you? Yeah, I did the same. Oh, well done. Be insufferable, wouldn't it? So verse 33, oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. The depth, the inexhaustibility, the riches, the wealth of the wisdom. Who would have thought of doing it this way? Who would have thought of grace overflowing and then overflowing back again like this? And the knowledge of God. Who would have thought of running the world and rescuing the world that way? How unsearchable his judgments. What a wonderful way to run the world. His paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? This is Isaiah 40. Who has been his counselor? Who could have said to God, let me give you some good advice as to how to rule and rescue the world? I couldn't, says Paul, nor could anybody else. And then a quotation from Job, chapter 41. Who has ever given a gift to God that God should repay him? Who's ever said to God, you owe me one? I'm a devotee, and my wife and daughter are devotees of the West Wing. Some of you may have watched the West Wing. And there's one occasion where the president's secretary has died, and he's very fond of her, and he's very angry, and he's in the cathedral after the funeral, and he's ranting at God, and he's saying, I've done all these things for you. You know, I've helped poor people to get to a better standard of living. I've educated people. I've done all these good things for you. Wasn't that enough? That's the spirit, isn't it? You owe me one. I've done all sorts of good things for you. Now you owe me one. No, says Paul, he doesn't owe us anything. We owe him everything, everything. Because verse 36, from him, because he's the source of all, and through him, because he's the sustainer of all, and to him, because he's the goal of all creation, are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. Now let's pause. Let me suggest three responses that we might profitably make to these great truths. First response, I want to encourage us never to give up on hard people. Maybe there are people in our families. Maybe there's an unbeliever in our family. And when they first hardened themselves against Christ, we were grieved. Maybe we wept over their unbelief. But you know, the really sad thing is that after a while we get used to it. You know, maybe there's someone in the workplace and their hardness grieves us or grieved us. But you know, we've just got used to it. And that's just how they are, and it's how they're always going to be. And we've just got used to it. And Paul is saying to us in Romans 11, don't ever get used to it. Paul says his earnest prayer to God, his heart's desire is that they may be saved. His response to these great truths of God's sovereign grace is to pray passionately and to preach for all he's worth and to live graciously. So don't ever get used to it. Perhaps that's a word of challenge to some of us. It is to me. I just get used to it. There's someone in our family who's not a believer. I've wept over that. But I just get used to it. You just have to go on living and just get used to it. And Paul says, don't ever get used to it. Don't ever get used to hard hearts. That's for one application. Second application, I want to encourage us to have confidence in the power and the persuasive attractiveness of grace to melt hearts. I want to encourage us. Sometimes in a church, we sort of see all the bad things. We see all things that are wrong in church. I mean, I realize, of course, all souls, there's probably nothing wrong. But in most churches, you know, there's sort of sense that, oh, I wish they didn't do this, or I wish they didn't do that, or I wish the staff were different, or I wish, you know, all that kind of stuff. And sometimes we forget that actually what is happening in real, authentic Christian churches is something that the world outside just can't see, can't touch, and hasn't got. There's something there they don't find in the office. Let me tell you a story that I often tell. It's about a Cornhill student. I'm not going to tell you his name or his country because it's a little bit sensitive because he's going back there. It's a closed Muslim country. And this young man was converted. I first met him when he came for interview. And I asked him, how did you come to Christ? And he said, and he was in his home country. He was 17. He was a farmer. It's quite important. He's not a poet. When I tell you what he said, he's not a poet. He's a farmer. And he was a very zealous Muslim. He said, I wanted to be a mullah. I wanted to train. I'm not quite sure what a mullah is. It's a bit like an imam, as far as I can work out. Is that right? A very zealous Muslim. Wanted to be a sort of Muslim leader. And his older sister was converted to Christ and very courageously told him. And she finally persuaded him to go to church. A tough thing to do, because when he went back, his father said, if you go again, I'll break your legs. But he finally went with his sister. And he said to me at interview, I went very reluctant. But he said, when I went to that church, he said, I had never seen such love. And this young man said to me, it melted my heart. Interesting thing for a farmer to say, isn't it? Never seen that in the mosque. Never seen that anywhere else. And there are all sorts of people in London who've never seen that in the office. Never seen that in the neighborhood. Never seen that at the school gate. And I want to encourage us to be confident that when a bunch of people live together under the grace of God, there is something profoundly attractive about that. Because there's a way of relating to one another that expresses the grace of God in forgiveness, in forbearance, in love for one another in all sorts of ways that the world outside just doesn't know. And when people see that, some of them will be softened by it. That's the point of Romans 11. And the third implication ought to be absolutely obvious, and it's Romans 12, verse 1. Therefore, says Paul, after Romans 1 to 11, not after Romans 1 to 8. Therefore, he says, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, and it's literally God's compassions, offer your bodies as sacrifices, living, holy, acceptable to God. When you and I understand Romans 9 to 11, I put this out when I was preaching on Romans 12, I put it like this. It was early in the new year, and I said, it's interesting what people put in their Christmas newsletters, but here's something a Christian can put in their newsletter, whatever the previous year has been like. You might like to think about this when it comes to Christmas 2008. That something that every Christian can put in their newsletter is, during 2008, God was very kind to me. You thought about that? You know, even if 2008 turns out to be a year of terminal illness or bereavement or redundancy, the Christian can honestly say, 2008 has been a year when God has been very kind to me. When God has been patient with me. When God has poured out his mercy and compassion on me. It may have been a severe mercy, as C.S. Lewis once put it. May have been a mercy in suffering. But every Christian in every newsletter can say, God has been kind to me. And that's the message of Romans 9 to 11. God has been amazingly kind to us, and therefore we're called to respond by offering our bodies as sacrifices to him.